Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
This is a serious issue. We either comply with international law or we don't. But we only have strength in our arguments because we comply with international law.
As Britain suspends some arms exports to Israel over its war on Gaza, we'll speak to the acclaimed Pakistani-British historian Tariq Ali about Gaza, Pakistan, Antony Blinken's visit to the UK today, and more.
Britain has cut off some arms supplies to Israel, but purely for symbolic reasons. They mean nothing. They have nil impact on the genocide that is taking place in Palestine today.
Then, as the official death toll in Gaza tops 41,000, we'll speak to former presidential candidate Ralph Nader about why the death toll may be a vast undercount.
There's going to be 500,000 Gazans that are going to die before the end of this year, not only from the bombing, but from the effect of the bombing in terms of the destruction of the healthcare system, infectious diseases.
We'll also talk to Ralph Nader about tonight's debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In the Gaza Strip, at least 40 Palestinians were killed, scores more injured this morning as an Israeli strike ripped through a tent encampment housing displaced Palestinians near Khan Yunis. Israel had designated the area as a so-called safe zone. Witnesses say at least four missiles ripped through the crowded camp as people slept, engulfing tents in flames, scattering body parts. The United Nations says its efforts to vaccinate hundreds of thousands of Palestinian children against polio were further delayed after members of a UN convoy were detained by Israel's military at gunpoint for more than 8 hours Monday in northern Gaza. This is UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Volker Turk.
Ending the war and averting a full-blown regional conflict is an absolute and urgent priority. Equally, the wider situation of illegality across the occupied Palestinian territory, deriving from Israel's policies and practices, as so clearly spelled out by the International Court of Justice in its advisory opinion in July, must be comprehensively addressed.
Monday marked the traditional first day of school in Gaza, but for a second year in a row, classes are canceled for all of Gaza's school children. Action Aid Palestine said in a statement, quote, going to school is not a luxury, it's a fundamental right, and yet hundreds of thousands of children in Gaza are being denied an education for the second academic year in a row. A whole generation is being denied the opportunity to learn and build a better future for themselves, unquote. In the occupied West Bank, mourners held a funeral procession Monday for the Turkish-American activist Ayşenur Ezgi Aygi, who was fatally shot in the head by Israeli forces Friday while she joined a protest against illegal Israeli settlements in the town of Beita. Witnesses say she was killed by an Israeli sniper after the demonstration had already dispersed. This is Lulu, another U.S. activist in the West Bank.
We're all very saddened by this. My heart and my thoughts are with her family, and we as volunteers here, we feel her loss. But we're not scared off by the Israelis. We are not scared off by this attack. We will continue to stay here in solidarity with the Palestinians for as long as we live, no matter what happens.
Ayşenur's family is calling on the Biden administration to order an independent investigation into the unlawful killing of a U.S. citizen and to ensure full accountability. On Monday, the State Department appeared to rule out a U.S.-led probe, saying it would wait for the results of an Israeli investigation.
I think most important is to let this process play out, for the facts to be gathered and for those to come to light. And I will just leave it at that.
To see our coverage of Ayşenur Aygi's killing and growing calls for justice around her death, Visit democracynow.org. Russia's military says it shot down 144 drones launched from Ukraine at targets inside Russia in an overnight wave of attacks that killed a 46-year-old woman in her Moscow home. Three others were injured as the blast tore through a high-rise apartment building early this morning, setting other residential buildings on fire. Witnesses described a chaotic scene.
We were asleep. I got up to go to work. I looked through the window and saw a ball of fire. I had just a second to cover my spouse with a blanket. The window got smashed out by a shockwave.
Everything is messed up there.
We were in shock. I grabbed whatever was nearby, children, the dog, everything, and ran away because we thought that our home would collapse as well.
Ukrainian officials have yet to comment on their latest drone attacks on Russia. On Monday, NATO warned Moscow over violations of Latvian and Romanian airspace by Russian drones, calling them irresponsible and potentially dangerous. Latvian officials said they recovered wreckage of an Iranian-designed Shahed drone that crashed 60 miles from Latvia's border with Belarus on Saturday. Meanwhile, Sweden's government says it's preparing to transfer Saab fighter jets to Ukraine as part of an increase in Swedish arms shipments. Texas is suing the Biden administration over federal privacy rules that bar investigators from viewing medical records of patients who travel out of state to have an abortion. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton says the rule creates a, quote, backdoor attempt at weakening Texas's laws, unquote, which ban nearly all abortions. In Missouri, an amendment that could undo the state's near-total abortion ban is at risk of being removed from the ballot after a Missouri judge ruled Friday the campaign to get the ballot measure did not sufficiently explain the amendment in the signature-gathering phase. Missourians for Constitutional Freedom, the group behind the ballot measure, is arguing its case today before the state Supreme Court, which will need to make an immediate decision since today is also the deadline for any ballot changes before they're printed for mail-in voters. Meanwhile, the Nebraska Supreme Court heard arguments Monday in lawsuits against two separate abortion ballot measures. Nebraska currently has a 12-week abortion ban. And in more related news, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis's election police unit has been investigating voters who signed ballot petitions for Amendment 4, Florida's abortion rights measure, which would toss out the state's 6-week abortion ban. Since it was formed in 2022, DeSantis's so-called election police have been deployed to intimidate voters, in particular, likely Democratic voters. The Justice Department has charged two leaders of a white supremacist group alleging they plotted to assassinate at least one U.S. senator and a district court judge. Dallas Humber of Elk Grove, California, and Matthew Allison of Boise, Idaho, each face 15 counts of soliciting hate crimes and providing material support to terrorism. Kristen Clark is head of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division.
The defendant's goal, the indictment charges, was to ignite a race war, accelerate the collapse of what they viewed as an irreparably corrupt government, and bring about a white ethno state.
Republican vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance is escalating his racist anti-immigrant rhetoric, this time targeting the Haitian community in his home state of Ohio. On Monday, Vance wrote on the social media site X, quote, reports now show that people have had their pets abducted and eaten by people who shouldn't be in this country. Where is our border czar? He asked. The Trump campaign piled on to the bizarre right-wing misinformation campaign, writing, quote, President Trump will deport migrants who eat pets, unquote. The first and currently only scheduled debate between Trump and Kamala Harris is happening tonight on ABC News. You can watch the debate at democracynow.org and tune in tomorrow on Democracy Now! For a recap and analysis of the debate. In Georgia, students at most Barrow County schools are returning to classrooms today, nearly a week after a 14-year-old with an assault rifle shot and killed two other 14-year-old students and two teachers, injuring nine others. Classes at Appalachian High School where the shooting took place remain canceled. The Washington Post reports the mother of the suspected shooter contacted the school on the morning of the shooting and warned a counselor about an extreme emergency involving her son about a half hour before the first shots were fired. The warning reportedly came after her son texted her the message, quote, "I'm sorry, Mom." Separate text messages also revealed the family was in contact with school officials about the boy's mental health a week before the massacre. Authorities in California and Nevada have issued mandatory evacuation orders for tens of thousands of people as an intense heat wave grips large swaths of the Southwest. Fast-moving wildfires are burning south of Reno in Nevada and in California's San Bernardino County, Orange County, and at the foothills of L.A.'s National Forest, as well as in Northern California's Lake County. UCLA climate scientist Daniel Swain said extreme fire behavior has also been observed in Oregon, Idaho, and Wyoming. In tech news, Google and Apple are facing billions of dollars in fines after losing their respective appeals against the European Union. The European Court of Justice ruled Apple must pay 13 billion euros in back taxes to Ireland in a legal case that spanned 10 years as it went through the appeals process. Separately, Google must pay a 2.4 billion euro fine for favoring its own price comparison shopping service over its rivals. This comes as Google's second major antitrust suit brought by President Biden's Justice Department kicked off Monday. At issue is Google's monopoly over the digital advertising industry. Last month, a federal judge ruled Google operated an illegal monopoly in the online search industry. In Florida, the Miami-Dade Police Department has released footage showing how officers stopped and handcuffed Miami Dolphins star Tyreek Hill as he drove to Sunday's game. The video reveals officers rapidly escalated the situation from a simple traffic stop to a violent detention, twice pressing Hill face down into the pavement, handcuffed.
Get out of the car right now. We're not playing this game. Get out. 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 What part of violence do you understand?
Statement, the Miami Dolphins wrote, "It is both maddening and heartbreaking to watch the very people we trust to protect our community use such unnecessary force and hostility towards these players. Yet it's also a reminder that not every situation like this ends in peace, as we're grateful this one did. What if I wasn't Tyreek Hill is a question that will carry with resounding impact," they wrote. Another Dolphins player, Calais Campbell, who came to de-escalate the situation, was also handcuffed. And legendary actor James Earl Jones has died at the age of 93. He took on iconic blockbuster roles like Star Wars' Darth Vader and Lion King's Mufasa, and is also remembered for films like The Great White Hope and Matewan about the 1920 coal miner strike in West Virginia. Though he became well known for his commanding, booming voice, James Earl Jones overcame a stutter that he said was so debilitating as a child, he sometimes pretended to be nonverbal for years. In 2003, Jones read the Frederick Douglass speech, "What to the Slave is the 4th of July," during a performance of Voices of People's History of the United States, which was co-edited by the late historian Howard Zinn.
What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days of the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is a constant victim.
We will play more of this performance in Peoples of a History of the United States, James Earl Jones reading the speech of the abolitionist and former enslaved person Frederick Douglass later in the broadcast. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, the Pakistani-British historian Tariq Ali on Gaza, British arms sales to Israel, Blinken's visit to London today, and more. Stay with us.
traz a lenha pro fogão, vem fazer armação. Hoje é um dia de sol, alegria de coió, é curtir o verão.
Vem Magalhães Rojão, traz a lenha pro fogão, vem fazer armação. Hoje é um dia de sol, alegria de coió, é curtir o verão.
Dê, 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 dê.
By the Brazilian musician Sergio Mendes, the Grammy-winning pianist and band leader who is credited with helping bring bossa nova to the world, passed away last week at the age of 83. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has arrived in Britain to meet with the British Prime Minister Keir Starmer and the Foreign Secretary David Lammy. The focus is expected to be on the Middle East, Ukraine, and the Asia Pacific. Blinken's meeting comes just days after the United Kingdom announced it's suspending some arms exports to Israel, citing a risk they might be used to commit serious violations of international humanitarian law in Gaza. Britain's new Prime Minister, Keir Starmer of the Labour Party, defended the decision.
This is a serious issue. We either comply with international law or we don't. And we only have strength in our arguments because we comply with international law.
Britain's Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, told the British Parliament last week many weapons exports to Israel would continue, including parts for F-35 fighter jets.
This is not an arms embargo. It targets around 30, approximately 350 licenses to Israel in total, for items which could be used in the current conflict in Gaza. The rest will continue.
Oxfam responded to the British government's move by calling for all arms exports to be suspended to Israel. To talk about Britain, Israel's war on Gaza, and much more, we're joined by Tariq Ali, the acclaimed historian, activist, filmmaker, editor of the New Left Review, and the author of over 50 books, including the forthcoming You Can't Please All, Memoirs, 1980 to 2024. He's joining us here in our studio in New York. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Tariq. It's great to have you in person.
Very good to be with you and Juan, Amy. It's been a long time since I've been in this studio, but 12 years almost.
Amazing. Well, today you're here, and Antony Blinken is meeting with Keir Starmer in London and the Foreign Minister David Lammy. There have been massive protests in London around UK policy towards supporting Israel in its war on Gaza. And now you have this stopping of some arms shipments to Israel. Can you talk about UK stance and the UK-US relationship, especially when it comes to Gaza right now in Israel?
The UK, Amy, has been totally complicit in this war. They've sent help. They've sent fighter jets. Their personnel are involved. So for them to pretend somehow that they're an impartial party is utterly ridiculous. This war has been supported by the Conservative government, and it's now being supported by the Labour government. Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister you just showed on the screen, as leader of the opposition, supported the genocide in Gaza, supported the cutting off of electricity, supported the cutting off of all water supplies. I think they have received legal advice that they have to do something or they are liable to international law by the courts. Not that that amounts to very much as we see these days. But I think that's the reason they've made a few cuts to the aid. But as they themselves say, these are meaningless. They're purely symbolic. And the bulk of the country now wants aid to Israel and military aid particularly cut off. The anti-war movement in Britain is one of the largest in the world. We've had, I think, now it's almost a year, Amy, since this war began. Almost a year. And we've had dozens and dozens of demonstrations, some including a million people. So the country is opposed to this, you know, across the board. But we have these governments in power. I call them the extreme center governments because right or left, they do the same thing. And why is Blinken visiting Starmer? Normally they send orders online. So why the need for a personal visit is to boost each other's morale? I can see no other reason for it.
And Tariq, it's not just the UK government, but most of the European Union governments. Could you talk about the wide gap between how these governments are dealing with Israel's war on Gaza and the rest of the world, especially the global south?
Well, the global south is more or less uniformly hostile to it. This is the biggest divide we've seen in politics almost since the Vietnam War. That the global south opposed to the war and the west very much in favor of it, Juan. And this comes across very clearly. Now, the other thing is that the demonstrators, you know, Jews, non-Jews, Palestinians, non-Palestinians who've been marching in the streets of Western cities are identifying here very clearly with the global South. So even in their own homeland, not to mention in the United States, the demonstrations and the campus struggles. So what we are seeing is a big divide on a global level and a divide on an internal level, where large sections, if not majorities, are against what their governments are doing in backing unconditionally what the Israelis have been up to for a year now in Palestine. And this divide is going to continue, given what is going on with the U.S.-China rivalries. And so this gulf now, which has opened up, is going to be difficult to resolve. I mean, whatever else, on foreign policy, I don't think there will be any big change in the United States, regardless of who is elected. So the demonstrations still go on a year later. All over Europe, including France. The Germans have banned demonstrations. They don't allow them because of their special links to the Judeo side and Holocaust of the Second World War, for which the Palestinians are now being punished. That's what's going on, and it's quite a critical situation because lots of young people who I come across and speak to are challenging and questioning the very nature of democracy, the nature of the system which exists, where one court, international court after the other, has said this genocide must stop, pressure on the International Criminal Court not to prosecute Netanyahu, which has been demanded. And so international law itself has now been questioned. So we are now at a situation where what the United States says goes. The decisions are made in the White House, in the Pentagon, in the State Department. These are the key institutions which determine what happens in Israel. And why the U.S. is doing this puzzles many people who are sympathetic to them. Why are they doing this when we've had presidents like Truman, like Reagan, like Bush Sr., stopping Israel from doing things like this when it was necessary? Now we not a single phone call. Both political parties totally complicit in this war. They might have other disagreements, but on the Gaza war, they are completely united, apart from indies like Jill Stein, who personally I would vote for were I a U.S. citizen, a sort of excellent politician. But apart from her and a few others, there's no one else in the mainstream who's come out against this. And this is very disturbing, I think, for democracy itself and for all its legal political institutions.
And Tariq, I wanted to ask you, in terms of you're talking about the state of democracy in your own homeland of Pakistan, Imran Khan has been detained since for over a year now, accused of inciting violence, a former prime minister. And the UN panel recently had findings that Imran Khan's detention is politically motivated. Do you think there will be any pressure on Pakistan to release him?
So far, there hasn't been any pressure. And Imran Khan, when he was first dismissed from office, claimed that the United States was behind the dismissal because of the positions he had taken on Ukraine at that particular time. He directly accused the State Department of having engineered his dismissal. So the fact that he is still in prison is a sign that the people who control Pakistan are the military. Politicians come and go. Political parties come and go. Politicians change sides in order to gain office. But effectively, Juan, it is the Pakistani army that has run the show for many, many decades. They make the decisions. They choose the politicians, including Imran. He was a military choice. And his successors are military choices. And now they are nervous because normally they can discredit a politician very quickly. They haven't been able to do it in the case of Imran Khan, and all the opinion polls show that were there to be an election in Pakistan, Imran would win by large majorities throughout the country. The army have now made him a martyr, they've made him a popular hero, and he's been locked up in prison on completely frivolous and bogus charges.
So there's also the discussion of banning the PTI party, the Khan party, talking about it. Inciting violence, leaking classified information. What would that mean?
Well, the classified information he revealed, Amy, which should be of interest to viewers here, is that a senior figure from the Pakistan Foreign Office wrote a letter back home from the United States saying that in the United States he had been told in very clear language that Imran had to go. Well, in Pakistan, as in other parts of the world, these letters they don't remain secret for too long. So Imran referred to the letter in public, stating something which most people knew. And as a result of that, they've charged him with betraying official secrets. I mean, there was no official secret. Everyone knew this in the first place. And so I think they're determined to get rid of him. Banning his party won't help because his popularity will increase. And if there's another uprising like we've seen in Bangladesh recently that could erupt in Pakistan, then they've had it. I mean, they'll have to shoot people on the streets and we'll see a repeat of the uprisings of the 60s and 70s.
And Tariq, I wanted to ask you about Bangladesh. The supporters of the former prime minister, Sheikh Hasina, have claimed that the United States was behind that as well, that it wasn't really a popular uprising as much as a color revolution. I'm wondering your thoughts. Is there any credible evidence that that is so?
I don't think so, Juan. I mean, you know, because the United States has done these things in the past, it can't do them everywhere. And what we saw in Bangladesh was a very authoritarian government confronted largely by students demanding democratic rights and freedoms and an end to laws which they regard as anti-democratic. And they won. She ran. She was taken by a special plane waiting for her to India and is now blaming the United States for this. In my opinion, there is no evidence to show U.S. involvement so far. Some may come out. We will see. But I think more disturbing is that the students who replaced her had no real alternative. So quite a few on principal parties, political parties and politicians who were there and are now in power or close to it are mistreating Awami League supporters, and that too is unacceptable. But in Bangladesh, as in Pakistan, behind the scenes in Bangladesh, it's the military who rules. The appointment of a sort of banker who became a celebrity and won the Nobel Prize, Dr. Yunus, very, very aged man, older even than me,